Hello, and welcome back to the Dive and Dig News Podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeological research in the Eastern Mediterranean. This week, we're going back to Malta, where, as part of the Honor Frost Foundation conference, myself and my colleague Dr. Anna Dimitriou hosted a session on maritime archives. Now, this is a subject that's very close to my heart. Archives in general cover a huge range of material, from archaeological objects to paper and digital archives. They obviously include sites as well as personal archives, many in museums and archive repositories, but still many, many undeposited, and this presents a real challenge for archaeologists. Not only does that mean we can't access them, but it also means that lots of knowledge is hidden away that, if we don't address, may be lost forever. So this session really reviewed the importance and challenges of managing archives, but also discussed how important these archives are to our understanding of the history of our discipline. So I'm going to talk now to my colleague Dr. Anna Dimitriou from the University of Cyprus, but also Julie Satchell from the Maritime Archaeological Trust. Some years ago now, Julie undertook a major study of maritime archaeological archives in the UK, which, as her paper that she presented in the session here in Malta demonstrated, this was a really useful guide, in effect, to how we might assess and think about archives going forward.
It was great to be able to come here and give a paper, because obviously I know it was a UK-focused paper, but I think that model in terms of how we tried to look at the massive breadth of largely undeposited archives for maritime archaeological investigations in the UK, that's a framework that could be used anywhere. And those lessons, you know, are really important for the discipline. We haven't had a structure for the deposition of archives, which means we've now got unfortunately got almost a 50-year backlog essentially of some archives. You know, to be fair, some are in museums and repositories and are cared for, but so many aren't, and so that means they are not only undeposited and uncurated, but they're uninterpreted and they're inaccessible, really. And so I think that was one of the things that really sparked that project. But also, as we got more and more into it, the research potential that's locked in them and not available, not just to researchers, but through researchers and interpretation to the public as a whole, I think that's a really important issue, because through archives is the only way the majority of the population can actually experience and interact with underwater and many intertidal sites. So they're almost kind of got a double value, if you like, in terms of not just in knowledge, but for access for everyone. And I think it is a huge challenge. I mean, there are some projects that have started to address some backlog archives, and I think that's the only way that's going to get addressed over time. But I think what you were kind of going towards is the fact that they're not just archives from sites, they're archives of the whole discipline. And through them, you can see the different developments as they happen, and the people involved as well. I mean, obviously that there's people directly involved on the sites, and then the personal archives that have started to be gathered, accessed and gathered, very much, you know, inspired by Honor Frost's archive and the deposition of that at Southampton. Yeah. That's really kind of sparked things off again in terms of thinking about trying to identify where those really important personal archives are.
Well, I'd like to move on to that in a minute, but if we could, because the three things you mapped out, but particularly this idea of, you know, site specific, but how that has a sort of, you know, change through time, and that's something that you've been looking at with the SHARE project. Remind me what SHARE stands for, Anna.
It's Shipwreck Archaeologists in the Eastern Mediterranean, the sites, the people, and the environment. So it's basically a project to collect, or maybe we could say also create, an archive on shipwreck archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. And as Julie said, it's to collect information about the sites, so the archaeological material that has been published in the region, but also about the approaches in terms of the research and management and the people that were involved in them. Not only the archaeologists, but also the people that discovered them, so maybe divers or fishermen, and also people that participated in different projects and in different dates, in different type of sites. So we are trying to collect this different type of material in order to be able to then analyze how this develops.
No, I mean, I think one of the things that I find really fascinating about this is the fact that we've got, you know, in some cases, massive amounts of data. That data is telling stories, but also it tells stories not just about the site, but also about how we have approached sites in different ways. I mean, obviously there are different drivers, and you know, that may be funding, it may be, you know, the research questions, but also how things have changed through time, the context of the way we investigate sites, the technology that we've been in, and a sort of, you know, the cultural context, the sort of social context. And I think that's something that both of you, and particularly with your SHARE project, that's what I find really fascinating, because that becomes quite reflective.
And I think it's very important to combine a type of information. For example, we do have the database with all the information about the sites, but also we receive information of an ethnographic or an anthropological approach, and this includes the interviews, of course, of the people that we're going to approach, but also it's another level. You can also receive information from, if you see how articles have been written through the years and how the shipwrecks and the sites were described through the years, so where do they focus through the years. So it's a multi-leveled research and approach.
Yeah, no, yeah. It is. I think it's really fascinating. When you were saying about the people who are you interviewing on this project?
We will be interviewing people that were involved in shipwreck projects in different dates, different types of shipwrecks, well preserved, not well preserved, and different types of research, excavation, reconnaissance survey, documentation. So we're trying to approach as many people as possible that have different experience in the field and from different countries.
So because the focus of the project is on the Eastern Mediterranean, but obviously, as we know, there are these things, or there used to be, or there are still these things called foreign missions when foreigners come and look at the archaeology. So presumably you're going to have to look at, you know, it's quite an international spread, I would imagine.
Exactly.
But that makes it quite interesting.
Yes, it is,
isn't it? So, and I mean, the other thing I know you're working on, you have a new project with my colleague Lauren. Can you just remind me, I keep forgetting.
It's called Listening to Our Past, Recalling the History of Maritime Archaeology.
Such a cool name, I can't sing it. But this basically, well, I mean, the foundation, as we know, set up this project called Soundings, which is really about an interview-based thing, talking with friends and colleagues of honour, but you've taken this a step further, basically.
Yeah, we are. We're really trying to target those that were involved in the very early years of maritime archaeology, kind of the 60s and 70s, and those formative years. And it ties in really nicely with Anna's work in terms of getting very much to the individuals and finding out about not only about their background and their career, but asking questions about some of their key sites and excavations, about how decisions were made. So there's so many so all of these steps in the archives, they're based very much on personal decisions that happen all the time, right from the individual person interacting with the archaeology, you know, to the site director. And it's really fascinating asking questions about, well, you know, how were decisions made in these early days when you were really you were defining the discipline because you were figuring out just how to do archaeology underwater. And that's fascinating, whether that was a collaborative decision for the team, or whether there was someone going, we're going to do it like this, and how, you know, the next stage is, you know, kind of then looking again back at the archives, but with this reflexive look in terms of how that how those were kind of making an impact in both ways.
Yeah, exactly. And are you just UK based, or are you trying to have a broader suite?
No, we are working more widely as well. So where possible, obviously we're English speaking, so well, that means that often. But we are working to build another. Hopefully another element where people will interview people in their native language to include other countries very much in as well, because obviously we're a global discipline and that our subject matter is completely global in terms of transshipment and movement. So I think it's I think that's really important to hear things in their own voices as
it's
well.
Absolutely critical. No, absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that I'm just putting a different hat on now, but the uni twin, of whom you're Matt's a member. No, is Matt a member?
We are going.
Oh, you're going to join.
Yes, we're being encouraged to
do it. Good. Very glad to hear that. So uni twin is basically the UNESCO. It's like a twinning, although there's lots of partners, and it's set up to encourage university groups, but also also NGOs and others who have a common interest. In this case, it's underwater archaeology in a sort of network. So they have dialogue, they exchange ideas and methodological approaches. But it's certainly one that could work really well. And I've tried to encourage people, but as you say, to try and encourage others around the globe. And in particular, I was thinking of getting, you know, academics to encourage their students to do bespoke pieces of work on this. But that's great. I'm really pleased you're doing it.
Yeah, and we're kind of thinking about our own archives of the archives work, because although obviously we are going to deposit them at the special collection at Southampton, when we are involving people in interviewing people in their country, hopefully, you know, ideally they'll have copies in their country, and then they can go into the broader archive as well. But very much hoping that they're all going to be available online, so that's going to be instant global access. So,
exactly. And actually, you've touched on another really important point, which is digitisation. I mean, obviously, when you're recording, as we are now, it's instantly digital. But I think this is another of the challenges of these archives, let alone the physical ones, but the physical in the sense of papers and letters and publications and that sort of personal paper archives. It's a massive amount of work, the volume of material. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it makes sense because it's been, you know, 50 plus years of our discipline, and we've got to wade through all that stuff globally to try and...
But it's a good point, because I've been thinking actually is that we're actually at a fundamental point now. Everything now is born digital, essentially. There's very little hard copy produced at all. And so we now, with these archives that aren't in repositories, they are at risk, and that it's kind of, we're at a period where we really do need to rescue those now, because digital rescue or digital archives obviously are going to be an issue for the future. But I mean, there are ways we can digitally rescue past archives, but I think it's been coming out more as we interview people. We're asking them whether they have personal archives and whether they're worried or know where they're going or worried about their future, and actually quite a lot of them are very willing to have somewhere to deposit them. So
that's a really good point. In fact, I was just having a conversation with somebody about this, but because if we think about it, well, if I think about this, because I'm definitely the oldest here, you know, I've got things on floppy disks and, you know, VHS even, all of these things, and they've become redundant. So in some ways, that paper archive has more longevity than some of these digital platforms. So it's that, actually, you're right, it's a bigger...
Well, yeah, but getting to the VHS, because you can digitise those VHS tapes now, but in kind of 10, 20 years, they're going to break down. And there are some crucial points, I think, we're at. I mean, I'm sure you've probably found similar in terms of the archives.
Not actually, because we're working on published material, so we're including the database information from the published material, but we will have to find ways to digitize the outcomes of the interviews, and we will have to find ways of sharing this material with the people, researchers and non-researchers. So this is another aspect that we should take into consideration besides digitization, is that we should make material collected available to the public around the world.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because the audience is really important. I mean, obviously it's like anything, isn't it? You've got to secure your data, but then what are you doing? Why are you doing it as well?
Right.
I mean, and as an academic, I'm thinking, oh, well, we must explore how we got here, and you know, but obviously there are people who want, you know, there's that broader public interest. So do you have, what are your plans in terms of dissemination?
So we will have the material collected on our website, which will have a map with all the sites with brief description of each site, and someone will be able to search sites based on date or whatever they decide to. And the database will be available on the website to download. And also the website will have a small description, an abstract, let's say, brief description of the interviews to download.
This will be at the University of Cyprus then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Okay, brilliant. We'll just say that our listeners know where to look for it. That's the main thing. Okay.
But that's a good point. Is knowing where to look, isn't it? And that kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's this wonderful woman called Amara Thornton who we met a couple of years ago, and she's trying to generate a sort of focal point for, it's archaeological, not just maritime, data sets, archives, you know, digital, obviously, so that instead of, you know, trying to make them all talk to each other directly, she's got this point at which, you know, she can say, well, here's a list of the archaeological sites from the UK where there are archives or whatever it is. And I think that's because it's really knowing how to find them is a big... And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to encourage, as you quite rightly said, thank you, Julie, for plugging the University of Southampton, the special collection in maritime archaeology that basically started with Honours Archive. And it's just... growing hugely. I know that Lauren's going to hunt down Peter Marsden's archive, and you know we've already got besides Honour, Sean McGrail and Lucien Bash and Nick Fleming. It's really exciting. It's but obviously back to that digitisation thing. It's critical because otherwise it's only a couple of students and academics or people that can afford to travel. There is the HFF Archive Fellowship, so that this gives you a reasonably generous grant to come to the university and spend hours drowning in paper so that you can, and really, some of the archive, I mean, Honours Archive is amazing, but Lucien Bash as well. I mean, some of the graffiti, I mean, it's amazing. And the other thing, as you say, is so many of these sites, okay, obviously the ones that were underwater that are being excavated aren't going to be there, but a lot of the things on land, so much of that's been trashed and we know it's no longer available. So these are unique insights as well into this material. So there's a lot to be done though, isn't there?
huge challenges. I mean, but I think just so much potential, like you say. There isn't a substitute to actually getting hands-on with those original pieces of paper and photographs and thinking about those, you know, those initial thoughts that the people were having, but making those available digitally is the only kind of way that to really kind of democratize that information and make that available to everybody. And so there's not those barriers to access, and I think digital will provide ways of doing that. You know, technology is changing so fast. I hope in 10 years time that we'll be at a stage where you can press a button and it will interconnect material from across different sites of similar one. And I think that will happen.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, that's a positive note in which to go forward. But thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts with this and your projects, which are both really exciting. And hopefully we'll meet again in 10 years and we'll press that button and it'll all be at our fingertips. So the challenge is really on to interview those pioneers and identify those archives. And if you want to find out more about the projects, head to the Honour Frost Foundation website and search for Listening to Our Past and the Share Project. Thanks for listening to this week's Dive and Dig news podcast, brought to you by the Honour Frost Foundation. And I hope that you'll tune in again soon. Bye.